We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts of bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in this room tonight and listening later on NAPAClub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Joy comes from We're Not a Glum Lot to share her experience, strength, and hope. I met her up in Buford when Larry Scott told a story one evening about 2 months ago. Larry highly recommended Joy. I didn't have any reservation about it. I asked her to get on the schedule, and she was nice and patient and waited for her day, and she was here early. I'm impressed. So let's hear more. Welcome, Joy. Please, everybody, give her a big hand.
Good evening, y'all. I'm Joy Williams, and I am an alcoholic. And it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm honored. Thank you, Tim, for asking me. My sobriety date is December 17th, 1980. And I have this cool little app on my phone, which is my favorite toy. I have 11,184 days since my last drink. And so I'm here tonight to just share a little bit with you about, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now in a general way. And I believe in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that it's what tells us how to stay sober. It's our basic text, and if I want to know how to live life, I will study this book. And I do study this book. My home group is We're Not a Glum Lot. We meet on Thursday nights at Dunwoody Methodist Church, and it's a big book study. And that's pretty much what we do every single week. And we start at the beginning, and we go through it, and then we start over. So I highly recommend it if you guys have nothing to do on Thursday night, or even if you do and you want to try something new, come out. We'd love to see you and have you there. So just to let you guys know a little bit about me, I was born in Kansas and actually lived a few years in Overland Park when I was a teenager before I moved to Georgia. My father was in the Navy. He was a pilot and was in the Navy for 3 or 4 years, I guess, before I was born. And my parents decided, you know, he was deployed and then came home and pretty much decided, okay, we're going to start a family. And I was born, I think, maybe 9 months later. I was definitely ready to come into the world. And about 4 years later, my sister was born. And in the meantime, we're moving around a lot. Lived in Kansas, then Missouri, then Texas, then Washington State, California, Louisiana, back to Washington State, and then back to Kansas, and moved here to Georgia right before I turned 15. So I went to something like 9 different schools, I think it was. And so, you know, something that I learned was how to pretty much make friends quickly. I wasn't necessarily that shy on the outside. You know, I could talk to you. I could strike up conversations with strangers, and that seemed easy. But, you know, being a typical alcoholic, there's also that shy person that is afraid you're not going to like me. And, you know, the truth is even today, you know, I really want you to like me. You know, I hope you like me. But the difference today is that I don't need you to like me. You know, it's okay if you don't like me. But I still really want you to. So, all right, so, you know, Dad's moving around. Dad's, you know, has another deployment or two where he's gone 6 and 9 months at a time. And one of the things about my family, like I said, you know, there was me and a sister. And, you know, I kind of decided Dad was mine and Mom was hers. And so, you know, when Dad was gone, I really didn't have anybody. I depended on me and I took care of myself. And my ambition in life was to get my mother's attention. And so I just did all these things to do that. I helped. I was, you know, I was responsible. I cooked. You know, I started cooking when I was probably 5 or 6 years old. I could cook breakfast. And just always wanted to please. You know, that's definitely one of my characteristics. And can be a defect. You know, definitely is on the defect list when I take it to extremes. So we're moving all over the country, and my father and mother both drank heavily every night. There were a lot of parties, and they definitely made drinking look fun. I mean, you know, it was cocktail hour and, you know, bottles of, you know, pretty colored, you know, liquors and pretty bottles and, like I said, parties, and there were a lot of drinks sitting around. And I think the first time I, you know, as an older person, I tasted gin, I thought, I remember this taste. This is good. I loved it. And I think I kind of sipped on it as a kid at those parties. And so, you know, my dad being, you know, a pilot, he was surrounded by a lot of guys. He was a flight instructor at a couple of the different places that we lived. And there were a lot of really good-looking men. And I was kind of a little flirt, and I, you know, definitely developed a liking for the good-looking men, you know, as a little kid. So probably around, I would say, 12, 13 years old, I guess I was, you know, I always could have a sip. You know, if I said, can I have a sip? Mom and Dad would definitely let me have a sip. New Year's Eve, we were given little glasses of a little bit of champagne. And when we went out to dinner and Mom and Dad ordered a cocktail, we got Shirley Temples. I mean, you know, we were definitely on the track to, you know, we wanted that cool drink in our hand just like Mom and Dad did. So, there was definitely a training kind of, I would say, involved in the way I grew up. And, you know, and I can say without a shadow of a doubt that my father was an alcoholic. My mother, I'm still not so sure about. She's alive. My father passed away in the early 90s. And, you know, he drank to excess often. And he was one of those that was just sweet as pie one minute and just meaner than a snake the next. And not abusive physically, but verbally and emotionally, you know, quite abusive at times. And it was always when he was drunk. Because when he wasn't drunk, he was just nice and loving and sweet and funny and charming. And, you know, and I adored him. So I would say around 13, we were living in Kansas. Friends that my parents, you know, perhaps my dad flew with him, but they were also Navy. She was a playwright and came to Kansas to one of her plays was being presented, and we went, you know, to see the performance because it was kind of close to where we lived. It was the University of Kansas, and there was a party, you know, a play party. And, you know, I got to go. And the college kids were kind of like, you know, I'm like I said, 13, 14, somewhere in there. And they were kind of like, you know, well, hey there. And they had some punch, you know, that definitely had alcohol in it. And my parents were like, well, you can have a glass. It's just punch. And so, you know, I proceeded to, you know, they were sneaking me glasses of punch. And Mom and Dad at one point came along and said, now, you know, now you be careful. How many have you had? And what did I say? Two. Come on. You know it wasn't just one. It's two. That's how you can tell an alcoholic. Because they only ever have two drinks. It might be, you know, this big, but they're drink, you know, two. So anyway, I loved the effect. I mean, you know, I definitely felt more vibrant, witty, you know, just interesting. I mean, I felt all those things. And I don't know if I would have said it was a spiritual awakening, but it was definitely, this is, you know, this is just great. Because all that, the feelings of, ooh, you might not like me, ooh, I hope you like me, was kind of like, you're going to love me. I mean, I was just confident. You'll love me. I'm wonderful. Just one or two drinks, that's all it really took. So, but also that was during, you know, the 60s. And, you know, what was going on in the 60s was definitely not drinking in my view, in my opinion. Because, you know, what I was hearing was sex, drugs, rock and roll. And I just thought that was the coolest thing and definitely something that I wanted to participate in. And so I kind of got the idea that drinking was really very uncool. And so I wasn't one of those kids that was stealing liquor from the liquor cabinet. I was one of those, I was, you know, reading up on, you know, how I could buy the illegal substances and when it could possibly be legalized, and was getting all these pamphlets, you know, and my mother is, you know, I'd, you know, written off for it and it came in the mail, and, you know, I've got these tins and stuff, and I'm like, yes, sex, drugs, rock and roll. And no alcohol. I mean, booze, so uncool, so uncool. My parents did it, you know, so that had to make it uncool, right? And so I really pretty much for the next several years through junior high school in Kansas, and then when I came to Georgia, it didn't take very long, you know, till I hooked up with, you know, the ones that were doing those kind of things, and, you know, we were basically doing that on all the breaks between classes. And that was several times a day. And, you know, my first year in college, I pretty much dropped all my classes because you really couldn't do that kind of thing before class and then pay much attention. It was pretty hard. And again, you know, just staying away from liquor because liquor was uncool. And, you know, I mean, my dad was an alcoholic. I knew that. Everyone knew that. It was not something that we were trying to, you know, hide or not talk about or be in denial about. He was an alcoholic and he was out there. And, you know, I just didn't want to be like that, right? So then I kind of found out that doing some of the things that I was doing could keep you up for quite a few days in a row. And I was really not good at that. So what I discovered was I thought I could manage that by drinking. And that was just like, well, this works really rather well. Because this means that all I have to do is, you know, drink so much every night and then I will go to sleep. Go to sleep. Pass out, whatever, you know what I'm talking about. So, and then at some point I was actually going to school to be a medical assistant, which is back then was really kind of like the forefront to physician's assistants now, because, I mean, I was, you know, there was x-ray and there was, you know, injections and we gave shots and did all that kind of stuff. And the very first doctor I worked for, I kind of got into the, you know, wasn't even locked up really. And she, you know, was the first person that said, Joy, I think you need help. And I'd like to help you. And it was one of those feelings like, you know, when you get called to the principal's office and you don't know what you did, but you know you did something and you're in trouble. I mean, that's how I felt. You know, like, uh-oh, this is not good. Because prior to that, I really thought I had it under control. I mean, I was like having just a blast. And I was having fun and, you know, and I was going to work if I had a job, and I was, you know, I thought I was managing fine. And when she said, I think you need help, it definitely sobered me a little bit. And so what did I do? I thought, well, you know what? She's right. I'm powerless over these things. Now, I didn't use that word because I certainly wasn't going to a program, but I knew that I couldn't handle drugs. I was pretty clear about that. But alcohol was totally legal. And at that point, I had really kind of become more open-minded about alcohol. And I decided that it really wasn't that uncool. And a lot of my really best friends, in fact, were drinking. So that became okay again. And it didn't take long. You know, it didn't take long at all. Because there was never a time that I really was trying to control it. You know, I partied and drank with people that, you know, the next morning would, you know, come to and go, oh, my God, I'm never going to do this again. And I'd just sit there thinking, what hypocrites. of course they're going to do it again. I'm going to do it again. And I knew I was going to do it again. And so I wasn't going to be hypocritical and say, I'm never going to do this again. So I thought, of course, that made me better than them in some way, shape, or form, because I was just so much more honest. Unfortunately, one of the people that, you know, I drank and partied with, his name was Larry, and, you know, we had a discussion one night, and I'm sure we were pretty, you know, three sheets to the wind, and he said, you know, Joy, I'm afraid we might be alcoholics. And I can remember just completely blowing it off and saying, oh, no, we're not alcoholics. Alcoholics go to meetings. We're just drunks. And, you know, I mean, I knew enough about alcoholics and alcoholism because my uncle was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew that. And my aunt went to Al-Anon, and my cousins went to Alateen. So I knew about the program, you know, but it was not a knowledge that I, you know, thought about daily. I just kind of could pull things. And then when I finally did need help, I mean, I knew where to go. I knew there was an Alcoholics Anonymous. But at that point, you know, I was having fun, and it was enjoyable. I mean, there were times that it was enjoyable. And, you know, if it wasn't enjoyable, I don't think any of us would do it. But like probably some of you, there definitely came a time when it wasn't enjoyable anymore, and it became, you know, scary, and I needed it. You know, I was talking to somebody recently, and he, you know, was not in this program and not a member, but he was saying, and I was just listening, and he didn't know I was a member of this program, but he said, you know, you can tell addiction by when people say, I need it. You know, like if you go into a store and you say, I need a six-pack, you know, that's a sign of addiction. If you go into a store and say, I need a pack of cigarettes, but you can listen, he says. And I'm like, really? Okay. Yeah. I mean, I definitely needed to drink, you know, by that point in time. And I had great reasons. And I loved the line, it drove me to drink. You know, I mean, I was driven to drink by so many problems. I mean, just, you know, I was, you know, 23, 24 years old. And, you know, living at home with my parents, I had so many problems. You know, I couldn't really keep a job because, you know, when you partied, you know, it definitely got in the way when you had to go to a job. But, so after this doctor, you know, had said, I think you need help, it was a few more years that I was out there really trying to manage it, you know, really trying to, keep the fun in it. And, you know, and I was one of those alcoholics that, you know, I drank your liquor, I drank your beer, I did your other stuff, I was the hanger-on, and pretty much, you know, in the last, I don't know, maybe a couple years, when people saw me coming, it was like, oh, God, you know, here she comes. And, you know, no one said that to my face, but I got it. You know, I knew that was, because I never contributed. You know, I never paid my way, I never contributed, I was definitely a taker. And I, you know, I used you for what you could give me. And I would have denied that to the grave, you know, because I really thought I was just so open-minded and honest and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I would never have, until I got here and was doing a, you know, a fourth step and then a fifth step, could I really see me for who I really was and what I really did and how I really acted. So, it got worse and worse, and I was working, and I think they were looking for a reason to fire me. And after about a month, you know, in this program, maybe two, I was fired from that job. But, you know, that's a little bit later. I'll get to that in a minute. I was leaving work every day, going to my brother-in-law and sister's house, and, you know, getting drunk and hanging out with them. And they had just had a baby. My nephew was born in 1979, and I got sober. I didn't get sober until 1980. And,
you know, they were always saying things like, you know, we're going to quit Monday, so, you know, let's just have fun now. And so pretty much every night that's where I would go. And the parties, you know, were all night. You know, I can remember at one point having a drinking contest with a guy. And I did end up winning that drinking contest because they determined later that he threw up first, even though I passed out first. And I woke up the next morning and I had a bruise on my chin the size of a quarter. And I was like, what happened to me? And they said, oh, we had some fun. We set you up. You know, we were playing cards. But when you passed out, boy, your chin hit the table like that. So, you know, I qualify. I mean, I did the things, you know, that, you know, wake up the next morning thinking, who are you? And just did things that later just felt completely awful about, you know, just... I mean, I think that's one of the characteristics of this disease is guilt. I mean, I came in here with so much guilt and so much remorse and just felt like there was really nobody that could love or accept me or like me. I certainly didn't like or love myself, and the idea of that was kind of like, what? I didn't think I could ever get there. And when I saw people in these rooms comfortable in their own skin and able to say things like, you know, I love myself today, it's just like, wow, how does that even happen? You know, how does that even happen? Because I couldn't get there from where I was. And I certainly couldn't get there from where I was without this program, without these 12 steps and without a spiritual awakening. Because, you know, the point, I believe, of these steps and of this book is to have a closer relationship with God. You know, and it does tell me that lack of power is my dilemma. And I'm looking for power everywhere. You know, I'm looking for something that's going to make me feel good, something that's going to make me feel accepted and loved and comfortable in my own skin. And I looked for it, you know, for years in drugs and alcohol. You know, I was lucky. I did get here young. You know, I've been sober over 30 years, and I feel like I've grown up in this program, you know, because when I got here, I mean, I still feel like a kid at times. You know, I still feel like I... At some point in time, I'm going to find out, you know, what y'all know about life, and then I'll be better at it, you know. But, you know, I've got a chance as long as I stay here and keep working these steps and keep working this program. So, two things that I want to share is, one, the friend named Larry that said he thought he was alcoholic or we were alcoholics, he died, you know, in a car accident. Ran right up under a dump truck on I-75, drunk, and I was probably a year sober when that happened. And then my brother-in-law, he died from this disease at 44. They found him in his bed one day. He just never woke up. He had all the, you know, he had cirrhosis, he had diabetes at the end, and nobody ever saw him drink. You know, nobody ever saw him with a glass in his hand, but he was drunk practically all the time. And the sad thing is both of those men were really good men, and they had a lot to give and a lot to offer. And, you know, they are not here today because of this disease. And it makes me really sad when I think about it. His son, my nephew, just got married last weekend, and I got to go out to Utah to be in that, be with them, you know, to celebrate that. And the cool thing is Steve, my brother-in-law, died just right at 10 years ago, and his family and I had a huge falling out after that. And even though I saw them about a year after that, it was still a huge rift. And I had done everything that I thought that I could, you know, to, you know, I prayed for them, and it was just a huge loss, and I got to heal that this past weekend. You know, I got to be with those family members that I loved and adored and spent many, many, many holidays with, and I got to be with them and love them and feel their love and acceptance, and that's a miracle. You know, that is a miracle. So, okay, back to, I got here, You know, and it's sort of embarrassing, and I say this every time, but it's my story. I, you know, my life was pretty, you know, pretty awful and pretty rotten, and I had a mother who went on a lot of diets, and it sort of, you know, was, well, if you wanted to get your life together, you went on a diet. So I decided, you know, I wanted to get my life together, so, you know, like mom, I thought, well, I need to go on a diet. I need to lose some weight, and I need to get myself together. And so because my uncle was in AA, I think I read somewhere that there was also an OA, Overeaters Anonymous. And I thought, that's perfect. That's exactly what I need. So I found the number, and I called him up, and I got a recording. And I went, well, screw you. I need help now. I couldn't believe it. I called. They weren't there. And I can remember just being mad as fire. And I was just, you know, I was at work, and I worked at a place that, you know, I was alone a lot. And so I was just, you know, fuming. Like, how could they not be there? And then God steps in, which I think he does a lot. Because I get this voice in my head that says, you know, Joy, you've been on diets before. And, you know, what really happens when you go off your diet is it's because, you know, you want to drink a beer or have a drink. It's not because you eat cake or... And so then it was like, you know, with that little bit of knowledge, I went, well, I know, I can call AA. Maybe if I get that handled, then, you know, everything else will fall into place. I mean, you know, where am I getting this? You know what I mean? If that's not God, I don't know what it is. So, you know, I'm get out the, you know, the actual phone book back then, you know, and look up the number and call AA, and I get Helen, love and bless her heart. I absolutely adore her. And I am like, hi, I'm looking for an AA meeting. Because, you know, I wasn't worried or upset. I mean, I was just, I found the solution to my problem. I mean, I knew this was going to work. And, you know, she gave me the number, and maybe she even gave me directions. I don't know. Because it was a Tuesday, and I did not go to AA that night. It was like a week later, and I'm at my brother-in-law and sister's house. I've been drinking. And at one point, it's probably about 7 o'clock, and my brother-in-law says, would you like to smoke? And I said, no, I'm going to a meeting. And I think, what? You know, where did that come from? I mean, I'm like, I like packed up my stuff and I left because I was going to a meeting. And honest to God, y'all, I did not know where that church was, but I drove directly there. I drove directly there, and I parked in their parking lot, and there were a lot of cars. And it was in Marietta, a little church in Marietta, my first home group, New Hope. And I think it was a little Presbyterian church at the time. Anyway, I pull right in and sit there thinking there cannot be this many alcoholics in Marietta. I mean, I had no idea, you know, but there were a lot of cars. And, you know, definitely the committee was going, you know, because it was like, well, you know, what if it's, you know, what if it's not? You know, what if you're in the wrong place? What? And then again, I think it was God, because I get this voice in my head that says, you know, Joy, even if it's a bunch of little old ladies knitting, why don't you go on in there? Because maybe they could help you. And I think at that point I acknowledged, although it was brief, that I needed help. And so I get out of the car, and I was definitely stalling. I mean, I'd cleaned out my car, I'd emptied the ashtrays, I had rearranged the trunk. And luckily I was standing outside the trunk of the car, and another guy pulls up, and I get up the nerve to say, is there a meeting here? And he says, you mean an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? And I was like, yes. And he says, come on in. And I'm like, quit yelling. Anyway, I go in with him, and you know, it's the smoky basement room, and I had quit smoking, you know, I don't know, a few months before, and I'm thinking, I don't know if I can handle all this smoke. I just really didn't like it. And, you know, again, God kind of came in there and just went, Joy, why don't you just try it? You know, and if it gets too bad, you can go ahead and leave. And pretty much for I don't know how long, that was kind of my deal. I was like, I just can't stand the smoke. And it was never so bad that I couldn't stay for the whole meeting, you know. And that very first meeting, I picked up a white chip, had no idea what they were talking about, had no idea what it meant. But when they said, do you want to try this way of life? I was like, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, it was a group of people sitting around this table, and I was sitting in a position where I was like, you know, from here to those steps, away from the steps on the wall. And even though I'd kind of gone through a period of agnosticism, close to atheism, at the point at which I walked into that meeting, I was ready to believe that there was a power greater than myself. And so I was pretty much going down the list going, yep, yep, yep. First three steps, I was, you know, I didn't have a problem with. I wasn't sure about, you know, the rest of them, but I was willing to stick around and figure it out, you know, and figure it out, because I knew that I was going to get the answers that I needed if I just kept coming back. And even it's like, you know, God was definitely working, because, you know, I know that, you know, we have singleness of purpose here, and this is an AA meeting, and we need to keep it that way. But at that meeting that night, an old timer, I mean, he had 17 years, and his name was Tony, and he called a group conscience, and he said, by God, you know, I need to know that this, you know, this meeting stands for what I think it stands for, and so if you, you know, anybody, group conscience after the meeting. And so they announced, you know, anybody who wants to stay, please stay. And by God, I wasn't leaving. So I stayed for the group conscience, and he talked about sponsoring a guy who was about to celebrate a year, and he'd asked Tony to tell his story, and the guy had been, you know, smoking weed. And he was like, that's not sober, and I want to make sure that this group, you know, feels the same way I do, and I want to take a vote right now. And we took a vote, and we took a vote. They took a vote, and I'm sitting there going, oh, no. This is not good. Because, you know, I was really all for the quitting drinking thing. But the way I had quit drinking a couple of times, because, you know, remember I talked about the diet thing. There was a few times that I'd, you know, got on a diet, quit drinking. But, I mean, I couldn't not do the other stuff, because, I mean, I certainly couldn't live life on life's terms. I mean, I couldn't face the day with nothing. So I sat there going, ooh, what am I going to do? You know, how am I going to do this? But I just figured, oh, well. And over the next few weeks, you know, going to the brother-in-law and sister's house, you know, that's when I would hear that, you know, well, you know, Josh is going to be a year old and we're going to quit on Monday. And so I'd go, well, okay, you know, it's just, it's not alcohol. But every time afterwards, I would think, what am I doing? You know, why? All the things that I had decided I was going to do that day or whatever, that evening, pretty much is out the window. I mean, I couldn't do what I said, you know, said I was going to do. And I just felt bad. And, you know, and I was around people every night, because I was going to meetings every night, that, you know, were happy, joyous, and free for all I knew. And they, you know, I wanted to fit in. You know, I wanted to be a part of what you guys had. And I did get a glimpse of the idea that that was not part of what, you know, what I was going to get if I continued to do that. And I'm, again, you know, God working, because there was a member of that group that had experience with that. And I talked to him and I said, you know, what do you do? You know, how did you give this up? And he was just like, well, you know, I just do it one day at a time, and I know it won't work. I know this program won't work, and I won't get the benefits and the rewards that everybody talks about if I keep doing this. And so it was then that I really got to put in that into practice that one day at a time thing. And it was also somewhere right around there that I decided that I needed to come clean to my family, and my sister and my brother-in-law about being in this program. And because, you know, I mean, I'd made grand announcements, and as a matter of fact, I was 25 when I, you know, when I got here, and it was December, like I said, of 1980, and the previous September when I turned 25, you know, I had a party. There was all these people at my house. My parents were there. I mean, and I made the grand announcement. You know, I'm gonna get my together this year, I'm going to get it together, and I'm going to quit drinking, and it's going to be wonderful, and I'm from here on out. And of course, you know, within an hour, I think I was passed out on the floor in the family room in front of the TV. So lovely, you know, at your own birthday party. But, you know, that was pretty much how it worked. You know, I don't know that I ever fell asleep. You know, I passed out. So, got here and started working steps immediately. I can't tell you I got a sponsor because I really wanted help working the program because I really thought that I could kind of do it on my own, and I certainly had the book. But I got a sponsor because I really liked when I heard other people say, my sponsor said, blah, 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 blah. My sponsor said, and they just seemed so recovered, and so I really wanted one for that reason, and of course I needed one to do my fifth step. And I did my first fifth step at 8111 in one of the rooms downstairs. I mean, it's totally reconfigured now, but, you know, I was on my way to feeling better about myself. And it was probably right around there that I got fired from my job. And, you know, the good news is I started going to two meetings a day. You know, I mean, I really wanted this thing. I wanted to get better. And I knew that I needed to take action. And, you know, one of my recent favorite readings is on page 317. And it's, I'm going to read it because I love it. And she talks about willingness and action. When I'm willing to do the right thing, I'm rewarded with an inner peace no amount of liquor could ever provide. When I'm unwilling to do the right thing, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. It is always my choice. Through the 12 steps, I have been given the gift of choice. I'm no longer at the mercy of a disease that tells me the only answer is to drink. If willingness is the key to unlock the gates of hell, it is action that opens those doors so that we may walk freely among the living. So, you know, even today, I mean, you know, I'm not perfect. I am so far from perfect. And honestly, I've been kind of going through a period where I'm sort of like, you know, God, I'm not getting what I want. And so what is prayer and meditation really giving me? You know, and that's, you know, I'm just being honest. I mean, you know, there's times that I'm close to God and I'm like I can't wait to get up in the morning and I can't wait to spend that 30 minutes. And I do spend it most days. But, you know, probably in the past month, I've just been, it's not working. I want more. I need more. You know, like some more is going to fix it. It's going to make me feel better. And it's not God. How could it be? You know, God is so nebulous. You can't touch him, and I can't feel him, and I can't blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, I have those periods, and you know, if you think that it's not going to be tough at times, you know, I'm here to tell you that it will be, but it'll get better. You know, that's the good news. It gets better, and it gets worse, and it gets better, and it gets worse. And you know, I've been married twice in recovery, and both of those relationships lasted about 12 years, and I've been divorced now for a couple, and that was extremely traumatic. I grieved a lot. I've lost my father, you know, to this disease, and I was diagnosed with hepatitis C, and I just went, no, hell no. And I did everything that I could to get rid of it, and it's been in remission now, and I prefer to call it gone, you know, for quite a number of years. So I don't believe anything's impossible in this program. I believe in miracles, and I know that if I stick around, I can continue to experience miracles. That's the coolest part of it, you know. Recently, the coolest part of this program has been sponsorship. And I have some ladies that, my God, they touch my heart every day. Every day. And I do believe that service is what gives me all the joy and all the feelings of love and accomplishment that I was looking for. And I didn't do it for a long time. I mean, there has been at least a decade or more where I was really busy living my life, and I really was too busy. You know, some of those years I was too busy to come to a lot of meetings, you know, very many meetings at all. And you know, it's the grace of God that I stayed sober. You know, I wouldn't recommend it. As a matter of fact, I highly do not recommend it. But, you know, the God of my understanding is forgiving and loving and just waiting, you know, really for me to say, how can I be of service? And then he gives me ladies that are going through exactly what, either what I'm going through, or they're going through something that I need to hear, because, you know, well, and usually I'm going through it. It's either rebelliousness, or it's financial insecurity, or it's relationship stuff, it's fear of intimacy, it's so many things that, you know, I've got going on. You know, it's like, wow, God, really? That's exactly what I needed to hear. And of course, you know, I'll say stuff sometimes that I'll think, wow, that has to be God, because I had never even thought about that. No one had told me about that. And yet here I am sharing that, you know, with some of these ladies. So I know that God is alive and well in this program. I know that he's here, or she's here, or it's here, whatever, you know, what, you know, it's the God of my understanding. It's the God of your understanding. It can be literally anything. I'm not a real, you know, I'm a spiritual person, and I would say that with no reservations, but I'm not religious, and I don't have a church, and I don't think that's right or wrong. You know, I think that for me, that's the way it is right now. I'm not against church, but it's not something that is part of my life right now. What is a part of my life is AA, and Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, you know, so many things that I could not do for myself. And one of my dear, dear friends, Larry Scott, says something that I think is brilliant. And I don't, it probably didn't come from him, because, you know, none of this stuff is really original, right? Well, Bill, maybe. But he says, if it doesn't do anything for you, it won't do anything to you. So when I've learned that about alcohol. I've learned that about a lot of things. But, you know, there's still a few things around that I kind of think this is going to do something for me. And when I'm thinking like that, it's usually I've stepped away from God, and I'm thinking a person, place, or thing is going to make me feel better. And my experience is that it usually does not. And that in the long run, it can actually harm me and make me feel guilty and shameful and remorseful. And so, you know, I'm just kind of fine-tuning my life with the help of sponsorship so that I know what makes me feel good and what doesn't. And I try to stay away from things today that make me feel crappy. You know, some of the things are like eating sugar, you know, or not getting any exercise. I mean, there's, you know, some of this stuff is so fundamental that it's like, whew, right over my head. Exercise makes you feel better? Really? Huh. Okay. I had to do it for myself, you know, repeatedly for a considerable period before I realized that that actually was something that helped. The last thing I'm gonna talk about before I close is the seventh step prayer, because, you know, prior to going to Utah last weekend, I really did a lot of revisiting step 6 and 7 and looking at, you know, how that, you know, my defects got in the way of my relationships with others and the love that I have for others. And so it reminds me of the seventh step prayer, which is, my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And, you know, I'm not asking to have all my defects removed. I'm only asking for the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness. And I don't know what defects are going to be useful and what defects won't be useful. So I just have to keep coming back. And that's what I'm going to do. Thank you for making me welcome. Thank you for allowing me to share tonight with you. And thank you that you're members of Alcoholics Anonymous and that you have these doors open for me.
Thanks for the tune-up, Joy. That was a quick hour. You know, I think I might be able to say my prayers and I go to sleep without taking a drink after.
Hi, my name's Angie and I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
And in the AA program, there's chips that denotes your time away from your last drink. And the white chip is for those that want to surrender and join this way of life. I would like to come back in after checking it out and seeing if it got any better. Hi, my name's Angie and I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
And in the AA program, there's chips that denotes your time away from your last drink. And the white chip is for those that want to surrender and join this way of life. I would like to come back in after checking it out and seeing if it got any better. Hi, my name's Angie and I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
And in the AA program, there's chips that denotes your time away from your last drink. And the white chip is for those that want to surrender and join this way of life. I would like to come back in after checking it out and seeing if it got any better. Anybody else need a white chip? Okay. And we have. And then we have a silver chip for 30 days in a row, and it says the time to call your sponsor is before, not after, and it took me 10 years to do that. I hope it doesn't take anybody else that long. Then we have, yep, he did mix them all up. Then we got a red chip for 90 days in a row. Then we got a yellow chip for 6 months. And a green chip for 9 months. And a blue chip for 1 year and multiples thereof consecutively. That really spoke to me, but if I could just pick three things, I think it would have to be that, for me, definitely God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And over these past 2 years, I've made AA a part of my life consistently. I've stuck close. And most recently, I'd say, for me, one of the most rewarding things is having somebody actually want me to help them. And that was a truly incredible experience, and it still is. And thank you very much. Are there any more birthdays? Well, thank God for the chips you hold.
So. Let's close the meeting. And I'd like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Who always makes a great meeting?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day
Oh, we got you in the